From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, a roundup of some of the major primary results across the state. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, shares his thoughts on what's next in the New York City mayoral race, and we'll pause to remember the 12th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Primary night was not kind to politicians seeking political comebacks, and it also offered a few upset surprises. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt has this overview.
Former Congressman Anthony Weiner failed by a huge margin to make a political comeback in the New York City mayor's race, trailing far behind winner Bill de Blasio and second-place finisher William Thompson. Former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer also was defeated in his attempt to get elected to a lesser seat, that of New York City Comptroller. But Steve Greenberg, a political analyst and spokesman for Siena College Polling, says Spitzer, unlike Weiner, is more likely to get a second chance for a comeback in the future, if he wants one. Spitzer, who resigned the governorship in 2008 over a prostitution scandal, received 48% of the vote to winner Scott Stringer's 52%. Weiner, whose sexting scandal continued to plague him during the campaign, got less than 5% of the primary vote.
Anthony Weiner hurt himself in this campaign. He hasn't rehabilitated himself at all. He's not in a position to, do anything else at this point going forward. Whereas whether Eliot Spitzer decides to run for office again or not, I think, the kind of campaign that he ran, the closeness with which he came, the sticking to the issues and not getting as much as possible into his past issues, I think has helped him at least with the public downstate somewhat.
Two state assemblymen who've been accused of sexual harassment, Vito Lopez and Micah Kellner, also lost their bids for city council seats. Lopez has already resigned from the assembly after paying part of a $130,000 settlement for two alleged victims. Kellner still faces a state ethics commission probe. Upstate, the mayoral candidates were relatively scandal-free, as incumbent Byron Brown won his primary in Buffalo, while frontrunner Kathy Sheehan was elected in the Democratic primary for mayor in Albany. Syracuse Mayor Stephanie Miner beat back two challengers. The biggest surprise of the evening was in Rochester, says Greenberg, where underdog Lovely Warren beat incumbent Mayor Tom Richards.
Clearly, the Warren campaign did a far better job than the Richards campaign in getting their voters to the polls. Nobody saw that race coming. The other upstate cities sort of went the way they were expected. The incumbents won in Buffalo and Syracuse by strong margins. The challenger who, for an open seat, the current citywide office holder, Kathy Sheehan, the city treasurer in Albany, was expected to win easily. She won easily.
Even Siena's own polls did not predict that Warren would win. In many cases, a victory in the Democratic primary ensures a win in the general election. That means the major upstate cities will likely have three women mayors and two African-American mayors. That's a big change from the recent past, where just one decade ago, all four mayors were white men. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Primary week, Alan, lots of places to go. Let's start in New York City,
sure,
where on the Democratic side, Bill de Blasio hovering just above the threshold for a runoff, but we're seeing that those votes might not be counted. These are ballots, about 16,000 of them out, won't be counted until probably next week. And in the meantime, they're pressuring Bill Thompson, the second place finisher, to get out.
Well, yes. You see, if Thompson, who of course is of color, would have come closer. But in fact, de Blasio has, you know, 40.2 or 3%. So that means that the distribution would have to change, and it would be just under the 40% if Thompson got a runoff, if he wanted it. They are telling him, look, you're going to ruin the whole thing, the whole party, if you do. Joe Loda is going to run on the Republican ticket. Lots of Republicans win in New York City. Don't kid yourself. And that's because the middle class, you know, has to always decide, do they want things to be more equitable or their interest with those who have more? And you have de Blasio giving a basically progressive social change message. And there will be people who have issues with that, which is why New York City keeps electing Republican mayors, liberal Republican mayors, but Republican mayors like Bloomberg, like Lindsay, like all these other guys. And we haven't in New York City had a Democratic mayor for 20 years. That's a long time. So it could be a lot closer than a lot of people think it's going to be in New York, even though very few people come out and vote in a Republican primary. Now, my bet is that Thompson will accede to this. If he had gotten, you know, if de Blasio had only gotten 30% or 25%, maybe. But he really did what he had to do in order to win. And my bet is that Thompson is, if he has any future in politics at all, says to the party, he won fair and square, and I'm going to step aside.
Let's go to some other mayoral races, Alan. And this has to do with Syracuse and Buffalo, two different cities. Now, in Buffalo, you have Byron Brown, who won easily.
And got endorsed by Governor Andrew Cuomo.
Exactly.
This is a case of exceptionalism. He's my friend. I'm going to endorse him. Parenthesis, he's going to win, so I have nothing to worry about. But in Syracuse, where Stephanie Miner is the brave, stand-up mayor, turns around and she says, look, Governor, you may have appointed me as the co-chair of the Democratic Party in New York State, but when it comes to the way you're proposing that we handle our pension and financial problems, I don't like it, and I'm going to say so. And boy, that was a real shot. So guess what? Cuomo, who endorsed the guy in Buffalo, who was way in the lead, doesn't endorse Stephanie Miner, even though I have to say she was ahead in the polls. And of course, the brave people of Syracuse turn around and they say, hey, wait a second now, this is our mayor. Don't bully our mayor. And they elect her overwhelmingly in the primary.
Now to another race. This is the sheriff's race in Saratoga County, and this is a Republican primary where the leader at this point was a man named Zerlo, and the challenger, Gildersleeve, had run saying that he would not enforce the SAFE Act in New York, and we've seen some trouble for Governor Cuomo when it comes to this issue. Does this strengthen the governor?
Well, let me put it this way. It wasn't the decisive blow one way or the other. However, Gildersleeve's is turns out to be, in some people's minds, not so great. I couldn't help that because, if you know anything about literature, the great Gildersleeve.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I can never help myself. The devil made me do it. But, you know, I think that gun control was this governor's greatest moment. I do. I think he knew he's a very sharp political operative. He knew it would cost him. He knows that when you have a tremendous bank account with people's confidence that you can spend every once in a while. And he did. He did it right after Newtown, and he's to be congratulated for that. And I have to tell you, it was a gutsy move. It was a profile in courage. And now, of course, all the gun people get together and they start kicking people out of the state senate in one state and doing that kind of thing because, you know, cars and guns in this country, very important to people.
Finally, Alan, in the city of Albany, a chance now looks like for the first woman ever mayor in the city. She beat out Corey Ellis, the former city councilman, and it looks like with the enrollment in Albany, she won't face much of a challenge in the general.
No, she won't. Look, she's almost there by acclamation. Albany is a troubled city. It's got all kinds of problems. You know, it has financial problems. It has education problems. This is a woman who is very impressive. We have all seen her in debate and other places, and she's a conciliator. She's a person who brings people together. She's smart, which I think is terribly important in these jobs. And I think that Albany, which is sort of an estuary. You know, the Hudson River, the salt water comes in, the salt water moves out, the fresh water comes in, the fresh water moves out. That's what Albany's like. The legislature comes in, the legislature goes out. So it's never really lived up to its promise. But I'll tell you what, this great lady shows us, and that is that there comes a point at which somebody decides that the people of the city will have a voice as opposed to the state running it all and the rest. And I think Mayor Jennings has done a very nice job of keeping things together, but I think there's some real hope in her election.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Environmental groups are renewing pressure on Governor Cuomo to make good on his commitment to reduce carbon pollution in the state. This week, the Research and Policy Center of Environment New York released its list of America's dirtiest power plants, including the five worst in New York State. The Innovation Trail's Jenna Flanagan has more.
Calling it the elephant in the room, researchers behind the report claim power plants are the largest source of global warming pollution. By their estimation, they account for 41% of the nation's carbon dioxide pollution. Eric Wallen of Environment New York says CO2 is what's driving global warming.
You know, I think a lot of the focus has been on ways to reduce your own carbon footprint and ways to cut your own carbon pollution. But the bottom line is, if we really want to solve global warming pollution, we need action to cut global warming pollution from the biggest sources, power plants.
The report is based on data from 2011, and two upstate power stations figure on the list. Kintaw Generating Station in Somerset was top, emitting almost 3.8 million mass tons of carbon dioxide. That's not enough to make the nation's top 100, though, when compared to the more than 21 tons from the Shearer plant in Georgia. The Dunkirk plant in Lake Erie also made the state's top five list, although half of the plant was mothballed in late 2012 and is now being considered for conversion to natural gas. The emissions from the five facilities made up over 20% of the statewide total. Governor Cuomo is proposing reducing the regional CO2 emissions cap from 165 million tons of CO2 down to 91 million tons. It would then decline an additional 2.5% annually through 2020. The environmentalist push for a lowered carbon cap comes in line with the Obama administration's own proposal to limit carbon pollution from new and existing power plants. This will be officially unveiled on September 20th by the EPA. In Albany, I'm Jenna Flanagan for the Innovation Trail.
Verizon has lost one small battle with government regulators, but the internet arm of the telecom giant continues its fight to create so-called fast lanes and slow lanes on the net. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
Verizon is making world headlines as it takes on nearly $50 billion in new debt in a massive bond sale to purchase Verizon Wireless from Vodafone for $130 billion. Consumer watchdogs fear customers will be forced to pay for that debt. Copper phone lines are very expensive to repair, and the internet is still largely unregulated. Using devastation caused by Superstorm Sandy to support its case, Verizon made a move to discontinue standard landline service on Western Fire Island at the southernmost portion of New York State. The company's VoiceLink service would have been the only choice for customers. Critics cited numerous drawbacks to VoiceLink, pointing out the service does not support internet or fax communications and requires battery power to operate consistently. The New York Attorney General's office intervened to stop the carrier from limiting its offerings. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman.
It's a victory for New Yorkers who were hit hard by Hurricane Sandy. My office is going to continue to oppose Verizon's efforts to substitute inferior wireless service for landlines anywhere in the state of New York.
Opponents contend that by setting precedent on Fire Island, Verizon can quickly apply the methodology to any other disaster area in the country in order to shut down landline-based services while abandoning portions of the copper line infrastructure. Verizon has agreed to give subscribers on Fire Island a choice between VoiceLink and VoiceOver Fiber at the same price as what they paid prior to Hurricane Sandy. Protests were scheduled for Thursday afternoon outside Verizon's internal offices at 20 South Hamilton Street in Poughkeepsie, pushing for the New York State Public Service Commission to stop Verizon trying to spread VoiceLink across New York. State Senators Bill Larkin, George Mazars, and Terry Gibson have proposed legislation supported by Communications Workers of America, the Working Families Party, and the AARP, calling for a moratorium on Verizon's installing VoiceLink throughout New York State and replacing landlines with wireless. Assemblyman Kevin Cahill's companion legislation has already passed in the Assembly. In another matter, the communications firm is making its case to loosen government regulations and allow some deep-pocketed content providers to use faster speeds, creating fast lanes and slow lanes on the Internet. Critics argue this attack on net neutrality will result in both economic and racial discrimination. Broadband providers would be able to start charging companies like Facebook, Google, and Netflix to reach customers. On Monday at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, lawyers for Verizon and the Federal Communications Commission faced questions from three judges who will decide whether the FCC's open Internet order stands. Jennifer Yeh of the Massachusetts-based advocacy group Free Press was in the courtroom. She warns the three-judge panel could overturn what's known as the open Internet order.
There will be no government oversight of our communications network, and corporations will retain control over what content we see, how much we pay for that content. In other words, our internet will start to look a lot more like our cable system.
Amalia Deloney is grassroots policy director at the Center for Media Justice in California. If the court decides to relieve the FCC of some of its ability to oversee the internet, she says that could result in certain groups and social classes being blocked from the web.
We need to be able to have groups like Iraq Veterans Against the War be able to express their anti-war views within the current debate between President and Congress and Syria.
Critics fear that consumers would also have to bear any additional costs involved in Verizon splitting services. Again, Jennifer Yeh.
During the court argument, Verizon was very clear that the intent of the filing was to ensure that they would be able to seek out different business models to gain more profit from internet access. For example, they would like to charge content providers to be able to get that access online, and they would like to be able to price discriminate to make sure that content owners who wanted to get their content to users quicker would have to pay higher rates. This is all going down to Verizon's bottom line and their hope to increase their profits.
The case is on track to be decided sometime around the holidays. Listen to the oral arguments in Verizon versus the FCC at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
This week, as the U.S. remembers those who died on September 11, 2001, a New York State senator from the Hudson Valley is calling on Governor Cuomo to sign legislation concerning the children of 9/11 firefighters. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn has this report.
Republican State Senator Greg Ball is urging Governor Andrew Cuomo to sign a bill into law that he says would help children of firefighters who died as a result of illnesses from response to and recovery efforts from the September 11th terrorist attacks.
They're just asking for equity. This bill would provide it, and the governor needs to sign the bill.
He says the bill would amend the civil service law and put the children of those New York firefighters who died on equal footing when it comes to civil service exams. The legislation awaiting the governor's signature would provide the children and siblings of police officers, firefighters, and emergency medical technicians who died as a result of the September 11th World Trade Center attack or rescue operations following the attack to receive additional points on a civil service exam for a position that is located in the same municipality where the applicant's deceased parent or sibling served. These points are known as legacy points. Again, here's Putnam County's Ball.
You know, it's a complicated legacy point system that awards the points to children of EMTs and siblings of firefighters who died, but does not award those points to the children of firefighters. We're seeking to rectify that, and we have to make sure that the governor signs the bill. Why the governor hasn't signed it to this day, I really don't know, and time is of the essence.
The bill clarifies existing law by defining the term killed in the line of duty to include deaths that were the result of either the 9/11 attacks or participating in the ensuing rescue effort. A spokesperson for Governor Cuomo did not respond in time for this broadcast. Ball says legacy points often make the difference between deserving candidates languishing on civil service lists for years and being selected to fulfill their dreams of following in their fallen parents' footsteps and becoming first responders. He has created an online petition for residents to sign, urging the governor's immediate signature. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
SUNY Plattsburgh was just one of many places around New York and the country to hold memorial services to remember the 12th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And at SUNY Plattsburgh, they paused to remember two alumni who died when the towers collapsed 12 years ago. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley attended the ceremony and filed this report.
The college ceremony was held on a sunny, windy afternoon next to the campus pond and fountain. The Army ROTC Color Guard posted the colors beside the permanent memorial that lies alongside Hawkins Pond in memory of those who died on 9/11. Senior political science major Nikki Schiebel is president of Omicron Delta Kappa, the Leadership Honor Society and sponsor of the ceremony. She explained that the college gathers each year so people do not forget the tragic events and remember its timeless lessons.
This memorial is placed here to remind us of all the individuals that died and were affected by the events that took place 12 years ago at the World Trade Centers. And the two Plattsburgh State alumni who perished in the collapse of the World Trade Centers. They were Robert Sutcliffe, a 1984 graduate who worked as a broker for Harvey, Young, and Yearman, and William Irvin, a 1992 graduate who was a broker for Cantor Fitzgerald. Can I ask everyone to observe a brief moment of silence in memory of all of those who were lost?
Lord, please let me hear you say, well done.
The Plattsburgh State Gospel Choir. Student Association President and Gender and Women's Studies major, Senior Vanessa Capon, says her generation changed in a single day.
The average current student at SUNY Plattsburgh was in second to fifth grade when September 11, 2001 occurred. Our world changed and our perspectives changed. It is now 12 years later that we stand here together with a strong and greater appreciation of what had happened, and a greater appreciation for the privileges that we have and the lives that we're allowed to live.
Special education major Jessica Pickett attended the ceremony because her father is a lieutenant in the Brooklyn Fire Department. She says her childhood ended on 9/11.
My father wasn't working, but he ended up running in after the first tower was hit, and he got in before the second one was hit, and he has ulcers, but they think that's because of the smoke, but other than that, he's okay. He helped dig out many of his brother's friends, and it's very, very hard day for me and my family. I think more people need to be aware that it's still affecting many today, and there's men who and women who are still affected by cancers and numerous other illnesses, and I think that this just brings some light to what's going on and that it's still affecting people today. It's not just 12 years ago.
Nikki Schiebel hopes the college keeps reminding students about the legacy of 9/11.
I was on Facebook one day, and it happened to be the day of the bombings on Pearl Harbor, and it said, nobody is even posting about Pearl Harbor. So I do worry that 12 years from now, we aren't going to remember what happened in 2001.
Earlier in the morning, Plattsburgh ROTC cadets climbed 110 flights of stairs in the campus administration building in memory of the 110 flights in the Twin Towers. The cadet stair climb raises money for the Wounded Warrior Project.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies of the program are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That number again, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1337. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.